You know, when you get up here on a Sunday to give a talk, and it's not your usual, you only do it a few times a year, it can be a daunting exercise. They do say that people fear public speaking more than they fear death. I can't say that that's true of me, but it does help rivet the mind. And death helps rivet the mind also. I want to share with you a recent experience I had, because it relates so much to this story of Mary and Martha, in which Jesus is counseling Martha to put her mind where it needs to be. And my story is about my mother's death, which happened just 2 months ago. She was 90 years old, and she had led a beautiful, beautiful, long life. So it was not surprising that she died when she was 90, but it took us a little bit by surprise, because I got the call on a Thursday night at about 8 o'clock. And she lived in San Francisco. I used to see her all the time. As a matter of fact, in her later years, the children, she had 9 of us, all took turns being with her when nobody else could be. And so she was very much a part of my life. And I went home to the house where I had grown up, where she had lived for over 60 years. And it had so happened that she'd been to the doctors, and when she came home for the very first time, she had trouble walking up the steps to the front door. So she was helped, and then she sat in her rocking chair where she was wont to sit, in front of the fire, having a cup of tea, talking to someone, listening to beautiful music. I mean, those were the patterns of her days in the latter years, when she was no longer that vibrant force that was marshaling 9 children to this and that and caring for us on all levels. But there she was. And my sister, who lived with her, had the presence of mind to say, "Mom, do you think you're dying?" And my mother looked at her and she said, "Yes, I could easily be dying." And then she went from there to a bed right there in the living room. Now, years and years ago, when my father built on the addition to the house, he thought big, and he made this a huge living room. And it became the setting for the last 3 days of my mother's life. And it was a dramatic setting. When you have 9 children, that in itself is a little dramatic. Some might say it's a little overboard. But she handled it, and we all came. And with us came the grandchildren, all 14 out of the 15. The last one couldn't, he was too far away. And all the extended family. And she lay there in the living room with the statue of Our Lady above her head, because she had so much devotion to Our Lady. And in that moment, everything else in our minds fell away. We all lead busy lives. We go from here to there. Truly, sometimes I think I'm like the ball in a pinball machine. And you know, you pull the thing back and off it goes and it careens. And I careen sometimes from this to that, from teaching classes to prospective parents, to writing reports, to literary magazine, to parent conferences. I mean, there's always something. And I know I don't speak just for myself. But in the presence of death, prioritizing happens seamlessly. And there was only one thing that was important in that moment, and that was my mother and how she was going to make her transition. So we sat with her in that living room, and we lit candles, and we sang, and we rejoiced in this most sacred moment of passing for her. She was so blessed, really, to have that as her transitional moment. And there was a tremendous amount of joy in the room, between the tears, because it was our loss. And on a very, very human level, we knew that this was the end of something so beautiful and full of grace. We were blessed to have her. She was a saintly woman. She gave us a life, a start in life that was spiritual, that grounded us in all those things that are most important in life, she and my father. But our loss paled in comparison to the reality that she was about to enter. So it was Thursday night, and all day Friday, and all day Saturday, and she was comfortable. And then Saturday night, I was sleeping near her on the couch in the living room, and I fell asleep. And all of a sudden, at 3:30 in the morning, Jose, my brother-in-law, said, "Her breathing has changed." And we leapt up, those of us who were there, and we went to the side of her bed. And you know, sometimes you just don't recognize it when it's going to come. We thought she just needed to be turned. And we had just catered to her in every possible way to make her comfortable in those last days. But no, it was really her time. And she took a breath. And in that breath, her eyes flew open. And they were these deep, big, brown, chocolate eyes. And she was seeing something. She couldn't speak. And I didn't have the presence of mind to say, "Mom, what are you seeing?" I was just taking it in. But she was seeing something, and it was not there in the room. She was already on that other side. As William Blake said to his wife, who was bewailing the fact that he was dying, he said, "Catherine," he said, "don't you know I'm just going to step into the next room?" And so she took another deep breath, and her eyes flew open again, and then it was over. And my six sisters and I and the granddaughters all bathed her body in the biblical sense and freshened her up and put on a new nightgown and put the covers up just perfectly so she looked beautiful and straightened her hair. But she was no longer there. We were just honoring the temple of the consciousness that had been with us for all our lives. That's all. She was gone. It was so evident. Just here now, then gone. But we honored her in that way, and we sang, and we laughed, and it was truly wonderful, full of wonder. Now, the children, my children, my sisters and brothers' children, don't have the perspective of their parents. And so for them, it was very unsettling to see their grandmother in the living room, on her deathbed, gone. And there were more tears from that generation than there were from my generation, because they haven't had the experience yet, but they're getting it. And yet even they were riveted in the moment, in that sense of God's presence in that room, in all of us there. And they said, because they tend to be a little cynical, and they haven't had the experience of spiritual community that we had. They've grown up in a church, the Catholic Church, that's been splintered and divided, and so the cynicism. But they said, "This was beautiful. Why can't church be like this?" And they were right. Why can't church be like that? Why can't we be like that all the time? There's one funny, funny story I have to share with you, because it captures that the poignancy of the event. And that was on Sunday evening. It was time for us to say goodbye. We'd kept her there all day long. But the morticians came, and you know, they tend to be a very kind of serious lot. And they walk in with their dark suits and their demeanor. And I know that they never had an experience like they had that night, because they walked into this living room filled with candles, 25 people, all of us holding a taper that was lit and singing, "Let thy little light shine." And they had to take care of business. And we didn't move. We sat there and watched them as they took my mother and put her in the bag and zipped it up and put it on the gurney and out the door. And we processed right after them, right out the door. And one of them, who was obviously a novice, he was learning. And the other would give these little hints about how to do things. And finally he turned to my sister, Patricia, who lived with my mother for the last some odd years, and he said, "Do you remember me?" And she looked at him. She said, "Why, no, I don't." And he said, "Well, I used to be your UPS man." And my brother, who is absolutely irrepressible, well, Patricia says to him, "Well, that's quite a career change." And my brother said, "Well, not really, it's just a bigger package." You know, we were like that for 3 days. It was just, you know, everything was just so spontaneous, and you just had this sense of proportion that allowed us to laugh and to enjoy. Now, it wasn't a tragic death. It wasn't a premature death. And so it was certainly easier, but it was a wonderful opportunity to practice for those times when it is harder to take the loss of a loved one, and never underestimate that sense of loss. But also, we can never underestimate the potential for experiencing the joy of a life lived and now the next stage for the person who's going through it. And that requires that equanimity that our reading is talking about. Jesus is saying to Martha, not come out of the kitchen, Martha, or bring Mary into the kitchen and let her help you. He's saying, whatever it is you're doing, wherever in the world you are, whatever the challenges, that if we but bring to them an equanimity of mind, a sense of perspective, an understanding of what the real work in our life is, then, and only then, will we have what we truly want, which is that inner joy, that laughter welling up, that understanding that this world is just simply a veil against something else. It's just right there on the other side, maybe, if you want to think about it that way. And so Jesus, in his expansiveness of heart, chides Martha in a kindly way, but he was chiding her. He wasn't even saying that there's a choice. He was saying there's no choice, that Mary has chosen the good part, sitting at the feet of the Lord, absorbing the emanations of the divine love that was coming from him. How often have we all wished that we could sit at the feet of Jesus? Maybe some of us did. I don't know. So our reading is about equanimity, about state of mind. And I love that word, equanimity. It contains in it that sense of balance and proportion that we seek, equanimity. I'm teaching poetry in the middle school these days, and so the kids are working with that particular meter called trochaic, equanimity. Got it? I'm going to take that word back to the classroom, but I'm also going to take that word into my life. Krishna says to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, he says, "Arjuna, you need to practice mental dispassion." And of course, that scene was Arjuna was on the eve of the battle, and he was having second thoughts. After all, the opposition was his cousins, his family, his teacher. And he was saying, "I don't want to do this. I'm not going to fight." And he throws his bow down. Krishna says, "Arjuna, practice mental dispassion. This is not the moment to get emotional on me. This is the moment to go inside and to understand what truly is happening here. That this is the battleground of good versus evil. And that it's an inner battleground, not an outer battleground. And so take away all those ego-driven disturbances in your psyche and get centered." And so Arjuna does, with Krishna as his charioteer, as his guide. And Krishna needs to be all of our charioteer. He's there for us if we would but ask him to come and sit right beside us. God is there for us. It's just we don't know it. You know, Master used to say, to tell that story about the musk deer who lives in the Himalayas. Do you know that story? It's just so beautiful. It's a deer that contains in its navel a little pouch of this musk perfume that's just so overpowering, fragrant. And it drives the deer crazy because the deer tries to find where the source of that perfume is. And it goes frantically here and there and everywhere looking for the source of the beautiful fragrance. And sometimes, Master says, it even jumps right off cliffs and falls to its death below, looking for the source, which all the time is within. And that's just such a beautiful metaphor for the truth of our reality. All the time, that source of divine love, divine joy, peace, inner tranquility is within, because God is within, if we could but know it. And so on our roller coaster days, if we can remember that and not squander those opportunities that present themselves at every turn to meet life with equanimity, that equilibrium that comes from wisdom and an understanding of what the true purpose of life is. Not work, not work, 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 but service. Service in the work of the Lord. And that changes everything. You know, sometimes I have parents who come into my office, they're thinking about a school, they've had unhappy experiences at other school, they're frantic to somehow preserve or find happiness for their children. And I sit there and I look at them and I remind myself, this is another soul and we are here together and this is the only moment we may have forever and ever. Take advantage of it. Be present. And that's our mission in life, is to be present with ourselves, with one another, with God. I'm reading an Irving Stone book called Men to Match My Mountains. And some of you probably have read it. It's not new. But it is the story of the Western expansion between 1840 and 1900. And that includes the settling of California and Oregon, Colorado, Utah. And it also includes the time of the gold rush. And there's story after story after story in that book of people who came over with this expansive notion of how they were going to change their lives. And they come here, and so many of them got sidetracked. And they go off into the gold fields, frantic to make their fortune. And they have, you know, their weapons, the pick and the shovel. And so, and there are stories of how they came to these places, and they dug for gold, and they found a little gold. And then they thought, oh, there isn't any more, and off they go. And yet, not too long later, somebody else came along, and they dug right in that very spot, only they went deeper. And they found the biggest veins, the Comstock veins of gold. And they made their billions. And I'm not saying they got eternal happiness. But I am saying that they didn't squander the opportunity to take something deeper. And they used their tools at hand. So what do we do in our lives? You know, the story of Mary and Martha is for us. We are the devotees who in our own hearts and mind sit at the feet of Jesus, of Master, of Krishna, and ask for their wisdom to come into our lives. And so what are our tools? Well, Master's given us all the tools. And the best one is meditation, our sadhana, in the morning and in the evening. And if we can just frame our days with those two things, then filling in the details of our lives as they unfold day by day with the spirit of the Lord, with the spirit of love and inner joy, becomes easier and easier. The danger is that maybe we're going to forget and lay those tools down and go off somewhere else. Or maybe the danger is that we don't keep our tools quite sharp enough. That we become, as we go along this path year after year after year, a little tepid in our practice. So easy to do. To begin absent-mindedly to sit in meditation. To become restless. To get sidetracked. And so it behooves us to find those models that become real. To find those events in life. Like my mother and her death. I mean, I can take that in. I can think about it. She's with me. And that moment where everything was so crystal clear will be always with me. But we have something else, too. We have a living model in our midst of someone who practices equanimity, who through his practice of equanimity just channels wisdom, and that's Swami Kriyananda. Swami Kriyananda, who is here in this country and right now in Portland, Oregon, came to visit our school, which is in this building and the one behind, just 2 weeks ago. And it was instructive because this is a very intense time of year. We're winding down. It's just that in academia, you never wind down. You never go out with a whimper. You always go out with a wallop. And so we are. So the energy was high. So Swami coming, that was a big thing. And he wanted to greet all the children. And I was taking him from classroom to classroom. I was tuning in to exactly his state of mind. And as he went from kindergartners all the way through to eighth graders, you could just see he walked in. He was centered. He sat down. The children responded in kind. He was so respectful of them. He never talked down to them. He understood exactly where they were. Now, in any occasion when you have a group of children together, it's always, you never quite know how they're going to respond. And you hope for the best, even when you or as you prepare them. And we did prepare our children. Barbara was reminding us, my friend and colleague, was reminding us that years ago, Peggy Dietz had come to visit the school. Peggy was a disciple of Master. He was a chauffeur for Master. She was a chauffeur for Master for a while. And she had this high energy. Barbara says, when Peggy came into the classroom, the turtle that had been hibernating for months woke up. And the children went crazy. You never know how they're going to be. Swami had a different kind of energy. He came in, he had such equanimity. The children rose to it. And they were absolutely marvelous. And what went between them in that circumstance was absolutely rich in learning for all of us who were there to see it. Now, because it's the end of the year, the eighth graders are writing their graduation speeches. And one of the eighth graders wrote about that. And this is what he said. He said, I will particularly remember the visit by Swami Kriyananda and how he said that it wasn't so much which God you were approaching or the approach to God. It was how you could combine energy and devotion. He said, I'll take that and remember it. And I thought, all right, what more could one ask? What more could one ask? And here he is, Swami, walking around, putting out energy, but I've never, over all the years I've known him, seen him either harried or hurried. Even when he was chiding me one time, he was so kind about it. And I remember in India, when he was in the car, ready to go to the airport, they were late, and he's saying, let's go, let's go. There was never that frenetic quality about it. And when it became obvious that people weren't ready, he just said, well, come here. And I went over to the car and he blessed me. Using every moment, being in the presence of God, milking it for all it's worth. That's what it's all about. That's what Mary was doing. That's what Martha was learning. And that's what we are learning. So to the degree that we could practice inner joy every moment, to the degree that we can practice the presence of God every moment, whether it's on our bike coming to school early in the morning, or whether it's when we're being tested by some person who gives us a hard time, whatever it is, to that degree, then we are truly, truly on our way to freedom.